So the response in the first paragraph is simply a summation, basically, of the argument of the chapter. No. In the Messianic writings, there are some particular words which describe functions. In other words, not new titles, not new offices, but functions of people, things that they do. But these were just common Greek words which describe the same functions in all spheres of life. The church turned them into ecclesiastical titles by transliterating them instead of translating them. Transliteration keeps the words foreign and outside of normal understanding, which we can all testify from our own experience. We talked about this when we discussed for the first time translation and transliteration. The advantage of translating certain words is that people can understand what you're saying. For example, if you translate teshuva as repentance, people understand repentance. The disadvantage is that you lose some of the meaning along the way. You know, the root meaning of the word being to turn and so forth. The advantage of transliteration is that you avoid invoking a foreign concept in the other language and that you faithfully represent the sound of the original word. The disadvantage of transliteration is that no one understands what you're talking about. Okay? And that's the case here. So you have to make very careful choices when you are choosing between translation and transliteration. Just to continue with that paragraph, transliteration keeps the words foreign and outside of normal understanding. It helps create a special religious world. In this case, a special Christian religious world, which is not Jewish and not biblical. Translating the words would have enabled people to understand them. So that last sentence is important because it's saying that these words were just describing functions. They were common words. There was no need to transliterate them instead of translate them. The words could have been easily understood through translation. And then the second argument, which Vicky was starting to make already, besides that, all of these functions already existed in biblical Israel. So no new context is needed for understanding what's being said. Any questions just on that simple statement of the thesis of the chapter before we look at some examples and details?
A historical question, and that is, it seems like in the early church age, it was, they were speaking Greek and I guess Latin, so wouldn't this have been more of an issue a little bit later on when they started translating into more languages besides Greek and Latin?
Well, a lot of this arises actually in translating from Greek to Latin.
From Greek to Latin.
And then all the other translations follow the Latin, basically, is the story of Western civilization.
So
the story in the East is a little different, but that's the basic idea.
Latin is different enough from Greek that the transliteration wouldn't carry over the meaning?
Right. I mean, I don't know Latin, and I only know some Greek, but from what I understand, Greek and Latin share some roots. But they're substantially different languages. You know, some roots are completely distinct. So, I don't know if it was mentioned in this chapter actually when historically these translations arose. I'm just assuming that probably most of them come from the tradition of the Vulgate, like the tradition, like, you know, some of the translations we looked at last time. But that, again, is a specific question that could be researched. Whenever they arose, they obviously have, because you can look in Bibles and in commentaries and see people discussing apostles, which is apostle is a transliteration, not a translation. You can see people discussing evangelists. Evangelist is a transliteration, not a translation. Deacons, that's a transliteration, not a translation, and so forth. So let's maybe look at Ephesians 4:11, which is quoted at the bottom of page 74. This is one of the most commonly quoted verses, I think, having to do with, I don't know what you want to call it, church, government, congregational organization, what have you. Messiah gave, quote, some to be apostles, some to be prophets, some to be evangelists, and some to be shepherds and teachers. Which of these hadn't been appointed in Israel in earlier times? Certainly there were prophets, shepherds, and teachers in Israel. But what about apostles and evangelists? Those are the two that are transliterated here in a way that doesn't actually have substantial meaning. Now, prophet is actually also I think, originally a transliteration. But it's slightly different in that it's been given much more content and much more meaning, partly by being translated that way in Tanakh as well. So again, we talked about this with Ekklesia. We had the hypothetical example. Let's say that in every case in Tanakh, Kahal slash Ekklesia was translated as church, and then in the Messianic writings, it was also translated as church. Well, then the word church might have a very different meaning than it does today, but that didn't happen. However, with prophet, it's translated that way in Tanakh and in the Messianic writings. So that's a different story. However, we don't usually read about apostles and evangelists in Tanakh. Nonetheless, they're there in exactly the same way that prophets are present in both types of texts. So it's a split in meaning that develops because of inconsistent translation. Sometimes translation, sometimes transliteration. Now, the basic argument for apostles is that the meaning is simply people who are sent out, emissaries. So it should, that any translation should attempt to convey that meaning, not create some special title for these people. And the same thing for evangelists, people who bring good news. So the any translation should attempt to convey that meaning, as opposed to creating some special title and some new office for these people. We can deal a little bit more in detail with that, as well as some of the other examples, elders, shepherds, teachers, bishops, deacons, popes, patriarchs, and so forth, presbyters, all of these different titles, which are simply based on descriptions of everyday terms from the world of Israel and the world of all peoples. But before we do that, maybe I'll ask Charlie to read and explain for us Shurhaki's translation of Ephesians 4:11.
All right, this is from the French, and it says, you want me to read it in French?
Or? Sure, read it in French and then explain to us what it says.
Il est celui qui a donné des envoyés, des inspirés, des annonciateurs, des pasteurs, des enseigneurs. All right, it's...
What was the last one, sorry?
Seigneur.
Enseigneur.
All right, it's... is he was given, I'm going to translate it literally.
Right.
Okay. So is he who is given, has given the sent, the inspired, some of the inspired, some of the proclaimers or announcers, some of the shepherds, and some of the teachers.
Right. Can you see the difference in this translation?
Sure.
Yeah.
It's a totally different translation.
Yeah.
It's just a translation from the text that exists without including all of Christian theology and interpretation and the whole structure.
Yeah.
It's just a translation from the text. Mm-hmm. It says he's given some people who are sent out, some people who are inspired, some people who announce, some people who are shepherds, and some people who teach. Mm. Just a simple declaration of, you know, different human functions that exist. Mm-hmm. Has nothing to do with different offices or positions. He didn't list benefactor there, but that's the idea behind the quote that I read at the beginning, where Yeshua is saying the rulers of the Gentiles not only lord it over them, they call themselves benefactors. So it might be the worst tyrant, but he's known as the benefactor of the nation. You don't be like that. Don't create these superfluous titles for yourselves in these positions and rule over people because of that. Instead, make yourself a servant of all, if you want to be a leader, just as I have come to serve you. And he washed their feet and so forth. So it's two different worlds, and the translation obviously is very important. Charlie, did you want to say any more on that?
I was reading John 1. This is great.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just jumping ahead. I like what he's done here. But he's mixing the Greek and the Hebrew together in this translation, which
is Judeo-Greek. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. This is really cool. So what can I say?
Well, did you have an example that you wanted to read from there, or if it's short? Or
John 1?
Yeah, I mean, looking at John 1:1, just at the beginning. And the head, him, and this is the Greek word, the word. And the word, and he uses the word logos, and Louis himself for God, and the Word himself, God, and he uses Elohim, the Hebrew word, the plural form for God in here. And again, verse 2, he goes, himself, the head for God. So I don't remember now what it is in the English, because this is...
Which verse is that?
John 1:1-2.
In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God.
So that's right. I mean, right. The head of...
If you go through that translation, you'll find almost every verse is different.
Yeah.
This is which gives you something to think about.
You can't have
maybe. Bobby, could you lock the door, please? Because it is a very valuable text. Yeah, I don't want to give that up. And it might inspire some of you to learn French, or at least Judeo-Greek.
It doesn't have the English translation to the French.
No. Yeah, and
I thought Charlie was just reading the English translation.
And by the way, it's a translation of Tanakh as well there. Mm-hmm. Now, and some of his renditions of verses in Tanakh are different also, but the huge cultural gulf does not exist for Tanakh. Some of the translation is revised for Tanakh, but this huge difference in understanding is taken away in this translation. It translates from the actual historical context, which is Jews writing about Jewish faith in a Jewish Messiah.
Mm. How would you translate the word Hamvorach?
Hamvorach? That's a good question. The blessed one? The one who is blessed?
In the English translation, it changed it to potentate.
Okay,
Like, potentate.
Right. Well, actually, I don't know if that was a Jewish translation or a Christian translation, but... In a lot of current Jewish translations, they change the meanings of words, too, from Hebrew in various ways, partly depending on the denomination of Judaism that they belong to.
Potentate, could you spell that? I mean, is that from a Latin origin?
Yeah, potestas, power. It's someone who has power, basically. Yes, exactly, to be able to have power. Potentate is like a ruler. Okay, should we move on in this chapter?
Yes.
Let me just note that there is a denomination, maybe more than one, probably more than one, which defines itself partly by the use of one of these transliterated titles. And a split took place because people insisted that there had to be one type of office instead of another type of office. And I'm referring, it's not the only reason for the split, but it's one reason. I'm referring to Presbyterianism. Mm-hmm. You have to have presbyters. Mm-hmm. Well, what are presbyters?
Elders?
Who knows? It's it's a transliteration. It doesn't mean anything in English. It will have to try to... So, in other words, we have to figure out what it means through some other means than the text itself. Mm. So it becomes imbued with a different meaning according to the likes or dislikes of a particular group of people who happen to be using that word. But if we want to go back to the original, we can see what the word actually meant in the language in which it is part, you know, in the language in which it occurs. It's actually a word in Greek, so we can look and see what it means in Greek.
Okay.
That's in the chapter. So we'll do that in a second. Before we get to specific examples, though, and you can feel free to try to recall some of the examples of the chapter that you want us to discuss, I just want to quote again from some Christian reference works that exist today to show again that what we're saying is actually really information that is available to any Christian. It's not something so unique. Now, again, they may miss some things. They may not fully understand the idea of Jewish Greek and so forth. But if you look in Christian reference works, you'll find essentially the information that is in this book. It's just not put together in understanding. And it is also, of course, not put into practice. That's the difference. You can find the information in these reference works, but it's not put into practice. It's not put into practice in the translations. It's not put into practice in Bible schools. It's not put into practice in sermons. It's not put into practice in theology. So here are some examples. Barclay's New Testament Notes. The word bishop has today an ecclesiastical sound which the word episkopos did not have in New Testament times at all. This is not a Jewish writer, this is a Christian commentator, okay? The word literally means an overseer or a superintendent. The oversight may be with a view to discipline, or it may be with a view to protection. Usually in New Testament times, the word bishop will give quite a wrong impression of what the episkopos was. He was the superintendent of the congregation. It has been said with truth that the word elder in the New Testament describes the church leader in his person, while the word episkopos describes him in his function. Now here's someone that you can see is operating completely within the Christian framework. He uses church, he uses New Testament, he thinks in those terms. So he doesn't have the understanding that we've discussed in the previous two chapters. And yet he says very clearly the argument of this chapter. In a regular standard Christian reference work. The word bishop has an ecclesiastical sound, which the word episkopos did not have at all in those times. It literally means an overseer or a superintendent. It's not a bishop. A bishop is a wrong translation. Let's go on. Smith's Bible Dictionary. Under bishop, the word originally signified an overseer or spiritual superintendent. The titles bishop and elder or presbyter were essentially equivalent. Bishop is from the Greek and denotes one who exercises the function of overseeing. Presbyter was derived from the office in the synagogue. And so talking about the someone who oversaw things in the synagogue. So again, you have basically the argument of the chapter described in a standard Christian reference work.
Easton's does the same thing.
Does it? Okay. I don't have Easton's, but I have New Jerusalem Bible as my final example.
Easton's does the same thing.
Yeah. Okay. New Jerusalem Bible commentary. Elders. After the model of the 70 elders appointed by Moses, local Jewish communities were governed by a committee of elders, or presbyteroi. Presbyters. This structure was taken over by Christian communities. Elders were carefully selected, and their office was seen to depend on the Holy Spirit. The president, or episkopos, from which you get Episcopalian, and our word now bishop, was probably chosen from among them. So you see that the information is available, and it's not even denied by standard Christian reference works. It's just not thought about, or not thought about enough to put it into practice. What's being said here is not really new in a lot of ways. It's just that people have built up a system and they're so attached to the system that the information doesn't make any difference.
Are you talking about the traditions of men?
Maybe. What did Yeshua...
Did Yeshua have something to say about that?
I think so. What did Yeshua say about the traditions of men?
That they nullified the will of God.
The commandment of God. You set aside the commandment of God, the mitzvot of God, with the things that he has said are right and true and eternal. You set those aside for the traditions of men. And so I do think that this is a manifestation of it, although, of course, it may not always be intentionally thought of that way. But this is one manifestation of doing that. Not for us to judge. I'm sure we all do the same thing in various ways in our own lives, and the Lord will correct us. But just to, again, emphasize that it is an important issue. Yes?
I wanted to ask what the full title of Easton's book was.
Easton's Bible Dictionary. It's just one more Bible dictionary.
So, again, sometimes if you want to verify these anti-Christian arguments, just go look in some Christian reference works and you'll find the evidence. All right. I guess I'll open the floor now if people want to pick out examples from the chapter. And we should do this, I suppose, with a view towards explaining the different terms here. Elders, apostles, prophets, evangelists, shepherds, teachers, bishops, deacons. And again, let me mention that prophets and teachers stand out for us, and some people do, but we usually don't use those words as titles and offices in the same way. Excuse me, that apostles and elders and bishops and deacons are used as titles, even though they're exactly the same type of word. But usually we don't use teachers and prophets in that way, Why? Because they're actually translated in a way that gives us a sense of their function. Some people are teaching. Some people are prophesying. So we don't think of them in the same way as we think of a bishop or a deacon. But they're the same category of word. It's just that some of the other words, like apostle and bishop, were transliterated instead of being translated, or they hadn't been translated the same way in Tanakh, so it's the same as if they're just creating a new idea in a new world. All right, I'll let you bring out some of the examples for this, and maybe if you can pick an example of one of the words, like apostello or something like that, which means to send out, and then explain what the word actually means and the distinction between that and, let's say, transliterating as apostle.
I think the one we use most is the deacon one.
Okay.
Because that's diakonos.
Mm-hmm.
And translated or transliterated into deacon. But it really means servant, and we use that in congregation as shamash, mm-hmm. as the helper.
Right, shamash is servant.
Right.
Which is, if people understand it, as opposed to just thinking of it as some other, you know, religious title, then they understand it's a servant. That's what the word means. How many people would line up for the position of servant?
Right.
Do you think it's one right over there?
Some people would. Some people would, which is
right over there.
That's like last week.
Yeah. Don't turn around. There's nobody else behind you. I'm pointing to you.
Well, that's an expression of what Yeshua said, that you should desire to be a servant. You know, if you want to be great in the kingdom of God, you should be desire to be a servant. So there's a different number of people, you know, if you just take a typical congregation where these terms are used. If you advertise for a deacon, and if you advertise for a servant, you're probably going to get a slightly different response.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
But that's all that diakonos is saying, a servant. You know, someone who cleans up,
right.
Someone who brings the oneg, you know, does all the chores that no one else wants to do.
You know, it's so funny. I would love to give a personal expression of that, if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean to monopolize, but this is just so perfect. I can't deny it. When I first expressed a desire to become part of the Messianic movement, the congregation I belonged to at that time was an independent fundamentalist church,
mm-hmm.
IFCA, which our pastor said stood for I Fight Christians Anyway. Anyway, his name was Pastor Olsen. He was Norwegian, but he had a very Jewish heart. He had a circumcised heart. He loved Jewish people. He preached out of the Tanakh as often or more often than he preached out of the Brit Havashah.
Mm-hmm.
And when I told him what I wanted to do, and he said, "Well, first we need to appoint you to a position where you can learn how to serve. So we're going to make you a deacon." And then he said, your tools are in that closet. And I went into the closet. There was a bucket, a mop, a broom, and a pair of shears. And for 2 years, what I did was cut paracantha bushes, washed floors, and cleaned toilets, and changed diaper tables. That's what I did for 2 years in preparation before they sent me out to down into the valley to become associated with Chosen People Ministries.
They sent you out? They made you an apostle?
They sent me out. You know, they literally sent me out. You know,
they had
a blessing. They anointed me with oil, mm-hmm. and they had the congregation pray for me, and they sent me out. Right.
Well, that's exactly the meaning of an apostle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you might not have given yourself that title, apostle.
But that's a title. Okay. He's also the guy who washed the floors,
right, yeah.
the toilet. But have you ever clipped pyracantha bushes? They have thorns like this.
But they gave you the title of deacon. They wouldn't give you the title of apostle.
No, they explained what it meant to me.
Because that's like...
They said, it's a servant.
No, but apostle we're talking about. Because you said they sent you out.
Yeah, then
that's the meaning of apostle.
Yeah,
someone who's sent out.
Yeah, then they sent me out.
Right.
Yeah.
But did they call you an apostle?
When they sent me out, no. They just said, we're sending you out now.
Okay.
After 2 years, one day they came up and said, it's time to go.
Did they have a title for it?
What, for being sent out?
Yeah.
No, they just sent me out.
Missionary or
they just told me to go
okay.
serve.
Okay, so they just stuck with the function then, and they didn't use it.
No, well, I ended up working as a lay missionary, essentially, for Joseph P.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Great.
Anyway. That is a good example. That's what a deacon is. Right. Someone who cleans the toilets. Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically. So you can see that translating the word instead of transliterating it creates a very different impression. A servant, someone who's there doing the work, as opposed to a deacon, someone who's part of a hierarchy. That's what deacon is. Someone who's part of a hierarchy. Yeah.
You just mentioned a term and saying that, but always kind of confused me.
Mm-hmm.
But lay people?
Yeah.
Okay, that's Peter's word. And yeah, yes, I think you caught him, actually.
What it meant specifically is that, unlike the other missionaries at Chosen People, I was not paid staff.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it meant.
So there's
I
an actual...
unpaid staff.
Volunteer.
A volunteer staff member, okay?
Well,
they called it.
What I meant more, because, especially in the sense of transliteration creating
good
the
catch.
Sense of an artificial hierarchy or artificial novelty in these offices, these... functions within the church, within the assembly, where did lay come about?
I think it's related. You have, again, you have a hierarchy
exactly.
that's created, and you have an officialdom that's created. So the officialdom includes not just the hierarchy of the type we're talking about here, but also, say, monks who become part of the official clergy. So there's a distinction between the official clergy and the common people. And sometimes that split was enforced through rules such as the common people couldn't read the scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the common believers. People who are supposed to be believers in what the scriptures said, they weren't allowed to read them.
That's
because
true.
They were lay people, they weren't clerics. Mm-hmm. So that is also, I think, a false dichotomy, and you're very correct in pointing to that.
That's true.
In fact, what's being described here is a community. Community of like people, in which certain ones in that community exercise different functions that are necessary for the community to function, just as in any human society, you have different functions that are necessary for it to function. You need some policemen, you need some school teachers.
Did you hear that, Bobby?
I heard that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Do you think it's true?
I'm
Do we
sure.
need the police?
Or we have chaos.
Exactly. So in every
way.
We have less chaos than if we didn't have a police.
That's because we have bad police. Good police.
So in every society, you need people to fulfill different functions.
Exactly.
And the same thing's being described here.
Right.
It's not saying there are two different species of human beings. The text isn't saying that. The church often did say that, but the text is not saying there are two different species of human beings, the people in the hierarchy and the common people.
And so is Chosen People Ministries.
Where does the term gospel come from? Because this says Besorah for good news.
Right.
In the Hebrew, I guess, and then mm-hmm. I don't know what that is in the Greek.
Okay, let's take another example. That's a good point. Let's move on a little bit to discuss some of these other terms. This is related to not just evangelist, but also evangel, which is another word for gospel, and usually in most languages is used for the word gospel. Gospel is an English word, actually, interestingly enough, which means good speak, good news. So actually, if we had retained that meaning for gospel, then it would be not a bad translation. It's just that no one knows that's what it once meant. It doesn't mean that anymore.
Right?
But think of Gottspiel.
No, Gottspiel is game.
I know, the game.
Gottspiel.
Yeah, God's game of sharing the good news.
Right.
Gottspiel.
Okay. That's very good. Charlie's coming out with a new translation soon. A playful one. but yes, I mean, the more common thing, though, that we can deal with now is just evangel or evangelist. Gospel is a slightly different case because even though it may have originally been a translation, it's lost that meaning because it's only associated with the Christian idea of good news. So evangelist or evangel comes from transliteration. It's a translation of Greek euangelion, which means a good announcement, really. It's the kind of thing that, if you look in a lexicon, it will probably give this as an example. It's usually a messenger who would come to a king with a report of a battle with good news.
That's the type of idea. And it's similar to the Hebrew, which we'll get to in a second. Yeah.
So when you said evangel, it reminded me just dropping the EU and just having the word angel meaning messenger or news.
Mm-hmm. Right, good. Exactly, a messenger.
Very good.
Exactly.
Very
good. So it's a good messenger, a good message.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Angel is another instance of transliteration where it distorts the meaning. Because
mm-hmm.
the meaning is a messenger, someone who brings a message.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But we transliterate as angel, and so we get some strange idea. That's not what's actually being communicated, regardless of whether some of our ideas about angels are correct or not. The meaning that is being communicated in the text is a simpler one.
This says, but Martha was distracted by all the diaconian
mm-hmm.
that had to be made, and she came to him and asked, Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do all the work by right. myself? Tell her to help me.
Okay.
What is diaconian?
Yes, what is it there?
Diaconal?
Serving.
Serving.
Just for...
Deacon.
Yes. Just for reasons of time, let's try to go through each of the terms, though. So we dealt with deacon... or diakonos as servant, serving. And there are multiple examples of that in the chapter, which you can read through again if you read them before, or you can read for the first time if you didn't read the chapter. And then now we've dealt with evangelist, evangel. We have some idea of what that means.
We've episcopos.
Well, we didn't really deal with episcopos.
Yeah, we did.
Pekudot.
Did we? Did we give an example?
We talked about bishop.
There's a bishop.
Okay.
Ones that oversee.
Okay.
He gave some Old Testament, examples from the Tanakh.
Right, well, that was actually just in the Christian reference works that we did. We didn't actually take information from the chapter yet.
Okay, you're right.
So maybe quickly we could take one example. I like the first example he gives, which is from 1 Peter 4:15.
Right.
Peter warns believers against being allotria episcopos. I.e. bishops of others, if you want to transliterate, but that's not a good translation. But it means self-appointed overseers of the affairs of others. So there's an example of how episcopos is an overseer, and if you're overseeing other people self-appointedly, it means, you know, a busybody.
Yeah.
That's what it means. Maybe we should make that a title in our conversation. I don't think there'd be a lack of applicants. I'm sorry, let me rephrase that. A lack of qualified, exactly. A lack of qualified candidates. Okay.
It's excellent.
Anyways, the idea of episcopos, as you can see from the examples that are given, is oversight. You're a supervisor. So you have episcopoi at work. They fulfill a particular function. Now, in that case, they may be part of a kind of hierarchy. But the basic idea is the function that they fulfill, not the title or position, as with the other words. And let's see, apostle. Apostle is a transliterated word.
Mm-hmm.
What is that supposed to be?
Someone who's sent
out for some reason. Again, you can see, as with ecclesia and synagogue, these words have much simpler and much more generic meanings than they're usually given in translations. An apostle is just someone who is sent out. The elders of Yahweh said to him, give us 7 days so we can send messengers, apostelomon angelus, throughout Israel. So if we were to translate that, or transliterate that, in the way that those same words are transliterated in Christian New Testaments, we would have to say that in 1 Samuel here, these people of a besieged town are saying, give us 7 days so that we can apostle angels throughout Israel. That's not what they were saying, right?
Send out angels.
We can make angels apostles or something like that. It doesn't make sense, and it's not translated that way in Tanakh, because that's not what it means in Tanakh. Well, that's not what it means in the Messianic writings either. But it's translated in a systematically different way there. Do we need to look at any more examples of these words, or is the concept basically clear?
Very good.
One. Okay.
I think that it seems to me like just the regular English word seems to be the very best. And it doesn't mean
And I think we'd have the same kind of trouble if we used Hebrew words. If we call the Shamash, if it's culturally here, we don't normally speak Hebrew. We're English speakers here. Or to call the evangelist, I guess, Ish Besorah, maybe, I don't know. It seems a little bit foreign. As foreign as evangelist.
Mm-hmm. For some people it is, certainly. For others it wouldn't be, if they have more of a connection to the original.
Yeah, if you do, culturally, if that is your language, but that, for most of us around this table and on the couch, it seems like English is.
Right. Now, there is one important difference, though. I agree with you, and I would say that unless we're going to use Judeo-English, then, and understand that we're using Judeo-English, then you're right. It's just as foreign for many people. However, there's still a significant difference between that and the Christian English that's produced by Christian New Testament translations, which is that in the Hebrew transliterations, you're actually transliterating from the original. And the culture and concepts that you're invoking are from the original language. They're not transposed into this new world. So even if it sounds strange, it's still going to refer back to something that actually exists in the text, as opposed to a world that doesn't exist in the text.
Hmm. Let me ask you a question in this regard. If you spend any time studying the history of Messianic believers from the early days on, you find that by about 200, or even maybe slightly before, all of these ecclesiastical positions are well-established and entrenched, okay, and have associated with them all of the authority and all of the power and all of the self-imposed or self-described majesty or whatever you want, magisterium. As a matter of fact, it's referred to by Chrysostom once as the magisterium.
Right.
Okay? Or at least that's the translation of the works of Chrysostom that I've read. Maybe that's a miss. Maybe that's a transliteration of what he said. I don't know. But how is it that you think, or how is it that we came to that point so quickly?
Yeah.
Right. When it is fairly obvious from the text that that was not the intent.
Right.
Mm-hmm. How did that occur so quickly?
Right. Well, here you're asking my opinion, and I'll give you my opinion.
Yeah, I'm asking an opinion.
This is my opinion. The way I understand it is that, as I've mentioned a couple times already, the process of separating Gentile Christianity from the original Jewish belief in Yeshua as the Messiah began already in the first century. And it's evident in Paul's lifetime in his letter to the Romans.
Right. That's very true.
And in many of his other letters, too.
That's very in some true. And a lot of commentaries focus on that, too.
Right. So if it began already at that early date in Rome, which was not a center of this new movement,
right,
which was probably a smaller group of believers than existed in many parts of the Eastern Roman Empire, if it had already begun there at that early date, then it must have developed very quickly. Now, another part of the puzzle is that Christianity in the Roman Empire actually grew very, very rapidly, despite the fact that it was persecuted by the Roman Empire. And you have to remember that Christianity had not been an option. There were no options at that time. You were either a pagan or you were a Jew, basically.
Right.
And so this other option became available, and a lot of people turned to it. Now, I'm simplifying to some extent. There were some other options, perhaps, but those are the basic two options.
Sure.
And that's one of the reasons, probably, why there were all of these Gentile God-fearers that we read about in the sources of that period, that time, who would go to the Jewish temple, who would go to Jewish synagogues and pray and seek to know the God of Israel without actually converting to Judaism. Some people did convert. But there were these God-fearers throughout the Roman Empire who found paganism unsatisfactory and were drawn to Judaism, or let's say the Jewish way, because it wasn't actually Judaism at that time, were drawn to the Jewish way in some form or another. And some of these, it's usually speculated by historians, became Gentile Christians and so forth. But in any event, the movement did spread and grow pretty rapidly, and we can observe from a very early date the attempt to separate from Israel. And then if you look at writings of the later first century even, and in the second century, you can see that the process is, wouldn't say complete, but it's nearly complete in the sense that they're already functioning in a different world. They're not functioning in a Jewish mindset anymore. They're inventing and functioning in a Christian worldview. And that doesn't become fully crystallized in terms of all its meanings and its theology until the fourth century, when you have all the great doctors of the church and the Council of Nicaea and all of that. But you can see that it's a different world even from the second century. Mm-hmm. The other part of the answer, I would say, is that even though texts of the period describe, to my surprise, Jews who believe in Yeshua as Messiah, living as Jews, even as late as the 4th century, some people would say even later, in separate communities, they are separate communities. They are not really part of the Christian world. The Christian world develops separately. Mm-hmm. And, of course, as we mentioned before, these Jews who believe in Yeshua are isolated from both sides. Right. They're isolated from the rabbinic Jewish community as well. Right. So for a period of probably centuries, actually, according to the way I've seen it described in some Jewish history textbooks, by the way, now, I'm not talking about, going from a modern messianic Jewish perspective or a Christian perspective or anything like that, but just in Jewish history presentations, for a period of centuries, perhaps, there were some synagogues that were what they call usually Nazarene, that followed the Nazarene, Yeshua. There were other synagogues that were Pharisaical. There were other synagogues that didn't accept the Pharisees. They may have been more like what became the Karaites, who don't accept rabbinic authority. So there were all of these different synagogues. A lot of recent works on rabbinic Judaism say that rabbinic control over the synagogues in the diaspora was not established until the 7th century, which is very late. So that, in other words, there were all these different kinds of synagogues until then.
Nachmanides and some of the other...
A little later, but they're saying that in the 7th century, what had been the Pharisees or rabbinic Judaism finally was able to secure control over most synagogues. But even then, it was not all. That's also when the Karaite movement becomes evident, which is basically a very clear Jewish religion that separates itself from the rabbis, saying we do not accept rabbinic authority, we do not accept Talmudic declarations of what the commandments are. So you never actually have a monolithic Judaism.
Right.
Certainly you don't have that in the first century, and any text that deals with the first century will say this. It's a commonplace now that you can read hundreds of times over and over that there was no normative Judaism in the first century. In other words, there were a lot of different groups. And that persisted for a while, even when the Sadducees were basically eliminated by the destruction of the temple, and the Messianic Jews were, or the Nazarenes, or whatever you want to call them, were more or less eliminated by the opposition from both the rabbinic Jewish and the Christian community, and perhaps because of being slaughtered during the Bar Kokhba revolt, as some sources tell us. So even after those things, there was still a great deal of variety, diversity within Jewish religious life or Jewish religious understanding.
Can you spell
Karaite? Karaite, yes. And Fred just walked in, Vovremya, as we say in Russian, right on time. Because he can explain to you what this means.
Karaite, that's a Jew that doesn't follow the written Torah. I mean, not the written, the oral Torah. He opposes the oral Torah, the Mishnah, and all.
And what does the word mean, therefore? I'm not spelling it right.
Is it from the root of Korah, to tear, or to read?
To read. Exactly, yeah.
Oh, they go only after the written.
Exactly.
Not after tradition.
Karaites are those who read. They read the text, as opposed to listening to the oral tradition of the rabbis.
They do the soli scriptori thing on the Tanakh.
Yeah, it's basically that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Only the scriptures, not the rabbinics.
They still exist. They're not in great numbers, but they still exist.
I've never heard of them before.
Right.
Well, here's something you might want to try this week, too. Go try to explain this to a Christian pastor. See what happens. See how receptive they are to the fact that there's some translation issues.
Yeah.
I tried to do that with somebody at one time. And he just completely, like, oh, you're just so full of it.
Yeah.
They don't understand. It's so entrenched in the church.
Right. And so, it's been entrenched for centuries now. Yeah. So it's very hard to break through, and you may be viewed as a little ridiculous if you even try.
And they'll tell you that the only reason you're concerned about this is because you're part of a messianic group, or because you're a Jewish believer, and you don't want to know the truth of what it says.
But the reality is the opposite. You should want to know this if you do want to know the truth of what it says. If you're interested in what it actually says, as opposed to the traditional meaning,
correct,
then you should want to know what the text says.
Mm-hmm. Another thing, answer to Peter's question. I see is Yeshua was the king of the Jews and proclaimed as the king of the Jews. The Romans had in mind to separate the Jews, to wipe out the Jews. And with all their false gods, there was... the timing's not good. We have something going on. But anyway... So during that first century, the Jews were, and throughout history, I mean, we can spiritualize it too, throughout history, the Jewish people have been tried to wipe them out, us out. And more so during that first 100 years when Yeshua was proclaimed as king, there was more of a diaspora that would take place, mm-hmm. and the Jews went into their enclaves and set up their own factions, so to speak. And whereas the greater body of Gentiles formulated their doctrines, which put them aside or put us aside.
Right.
I got to deal with this.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true.
Isaiah, can I ask you one other question, sort of unrelated, but what do you think about Tyndale's Bible?
Okay, I look at it positively, especially for his attempt to be accurate. I don't think that it's the...
perfect.
It's certainly not perfect, and it's not the kind of translation that would necessarily be a lot better to read today than some of the other translations we have, like New American Standard or something. It would be useful to read alongside them, but it's available in a new edition, and
it's definitely
worth getting and reading. And it avoids
$10, right?
Right? Yeah, and it avoids some of the mistakes of these later translations.
But isn't it archaic?
Well, the new edition is actually modernized. Okay. I don't remember how modernized, but to a certain extent, it's modernized.
Okay.
Gave his life for that book.
Right. Yeah, so I respect him as a person very much and what he was attempting to accomplish, and I respect his work. It's not really an original translation from Jewish Greek, which is what we're hoping to have at some point. Let me just sum up by reading some excerpts from the end of the chapter, which basically sums up the things that were discussed. And in speaking about all of these different positions, prophets, shepherds, pastors, teachers, deacons, apostles, some of those words are bad words to use, but you understand that what we're talking about. He's talking about what's really described in the text. It is primarily service, not title, position, or authority that is in view. With most of these terms, that's how they're interpreted, as a title, a position, an authority. That's not what's being described in the text, and that would be contrary to what Yeshua said about not seeking those things and instead seeking to serve.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's primarily service that's involved. There were, of course, many kinds of servants in Israel. The patriarchs had them, kings had them, sometimes even prophets had them. When a word is translated instead of transliterated, the title disappears, but the function becomes clear. The transliteration serves to create an aura of a religious realm that is separate from common life. In the religious realm, there are deacons who do not serve. There are servants who are not servants, because they have a position, a title, and a particular authority in that world. All of the forms of service that are mentioned in the Messianic writings are also mentioned in Tanakh. they all existed in the biblical context of Israel. None of these forms of service required a new context. In Tanakh, God describes Messiah as functioning in Israel, the context that he created. So there's no need to create this new religious world. There's no need to create this church with all these new offices and positions. God already created a world, actually, mm-hmm. in which he said, and he said specifically that Messiah would come from Israel, from that world. Here's one example. As Paul expressed it in identifying himself in Romans 1, Paul, a servant of Yeshua the Messiah, called to be an ambassador and set apart for the good news of God, the good news he promised beforehand through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures regarding his son, who came physically as a descendant of David. We talked about some instances last time of the good news in Tanakh. Most people don't know that the gospel is from Tanakh, like the New Covenant is from Tanakh. But it is, if properly understood. The good news was promised by God in the prophets, in the Hebrew prophets. God promised the good news to Israel through the prophets. Yeshua came to fulfill that promise, not to abolish it. The creation of an ecclesiastical vocabulary obscures this reality and creates an alternate, anti-biblical context. Christian doctrine in opposition to the Jewish people misidentifies and mischaracterizes the ecclesia which God established. It creates the illusion of a God separating from Israel, but the new covenant which brings redemption is made with Israel. It is not made with a new Israel. It is made with the same old Israel, whose fathers broke the covenant that God made with them at Sinai after he brought them out of Egypt. And it's stated that way because that's the way God states it in Jeremiah. He says, "The days are coming when I will make a covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with them when I took them by the hand out of Egypt, my covenant which they broke, though I was a husband to them." So it's the same old Israel that broke the old covenant that is getting the new covenant with God. And basically, the end of it sort of ties together some information from previous chapters. When Yeshua said salvation is from the Jews, he meant the Jews who are Jews, not Gentiles who are Gentiles. Church ecclesiology is not biblical ecclesiology. In other words, the study of the word ecclesia, if you want to understand it from a biblical perspective, is different from the way it's understood in the church. And I think we've seen that. And obviously, the specific meanings that we looked at are very important. They have ramifications for how people act, how people see themselves, how people see other people in their communities. So all of this is extremely important. I think, again, though, it has a broader significance just in terms of the whole idea of being a servant, which is something that Yeshua was pretty clear on and which seemed to be important, that the way of the world, which works for most governments and societies, or should we say does not work very well for most governments and societies, with people on the top who lord it over others and are called the benefactors, that model is not supposed to be the model for God's kahal, for God's community. And if we understand these terms better, we can probably understand better how to integrate that teaching into our own lives and into our own communities. Amen.
Okay.